I always focus on the storyteller. It's not that I have a preference or a specialty, but it happens that the type of stories that we're making attract other similar stories. And so yes, a large percentage, 92% of our collaborators are women of color, but that's not by design, it's really by default because of the type of storytelling that we want to do. She had me at astronauts menstruating in space.
Julika, what do you think the theme songs should be for this podcast?
So for my episode, definitely Who Run the World, Girls by Beyonce.
Love it.
Or Independent Women by Destiny's Child, because I'm going to be a teenager for as long as I can get away with it.
I have to explain why you're spontaneously standing in your closet.
Making my son wait for lunch, by the way.
I read great news about your company, and I thought, I got to get her on the phone. Julika Lentigua Williams and Company. You're the CEO.
I am.
The founder.
I am.
Hey, I'm E.B. Moss, and this is episode 12 of Insider Interviews. And I literally got joined very spontaneously. I called Julika Lentigua Williams about, I don't know, an hour before we started recording when I read that she'd hit 100 episodes of her show, and she agreed to hop on a call. But she's a pro. She's been around the microphone. She's been around the pen and the computer and the print and the television.
A lot. And the printing press.
That's right. So she hopped on. You've gotten a lot of news lately.
Well, it's been 3 years. We've been working really hard for 3 years, and it feels like some of our work is really bearing fruit right now. We have had the most unbelievable first half of 2020. And obviously, it's been very sobering to be in production during the pandemic with my team distributed literally around the globe. But then we've had these pockets of just bursts of happiness. The latest one was that one of our flagship shows, Latina to Latina, hit 100 episodes. It's the first one of our babies to hit 100 episodes. So it's kind of a big deal.
Yeah. Well, we're going to talk about all your babies, and so that we don't keep your two babies waiting too much longer for lunch.
Okay.
Okay. You are, as I said, the CEO of Lentigua Williams, which is eponymous. That's your last name. And you are the producer of podcasts such as 70 Million, Latina to Latina, which you just mentioned, Feeling My Flow, which we're going to talk about. And you have a master's in journalism, an MFA in creative nonfiction. And I just am feeling really insecure now. So.
No reason to whatsoever. Yeah, I am having a lot of fun doing exactly what I'm supposed to be doing right now professionally. And I feel so blessed and so lucky. So there's a little bit of like being driven by fear that it could be taken away. So I just wake up and I'm like, okay, what do I need to do today?
I've heard you talk about your insomnia before that's driven by perfectionism, and you call it your BFF insomnia, which keeps you up all night.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, she's worse than a period, right? Like with your period, you more or less get those 28 days. Not with this bitch. She's just like, hey, what's popping? It's 3 a.m. You want to hang? I used to hate her. I used to curse at her. Mm-hmm. I used to throw tantrums at her. And then I realized, just be friends with her. And maybe she'll be more forgiving. And then after that, I realized, well, put her to work. She wants to show up at ungodly hours, put her to work. And so she and I stay up through the night and we make lists. We open tabs to be read later. And I always have these research projects on my to-do list. I just hop on one of those research projects. And so I really have made a place for her in my life because she's not going anywhere. This is the thing that was made very clear to me, especially after I became an entrepreneur. She's not going anywhere. And so I might as well put her to work.
I love that you've humanized perfectionism. That's awesome. And that drive got you through a lot of things, your BFF and you. You said that you've been everything from an intern to a producer. You're a writer, you're an editor. And then in 2017, you launched a company as a founder. So what did you need to do? What did you and your BFF perfectionism and drive need to do to learn to fill in the blanks that you were missing to be a founder?
The very first step in starting the company was to ask for help and support. And of course, the first people that I had to ask for help and support were my family. So my husband and my two children, who were younger than 7 and 5 at that point. And so I said to them, hey, I really want to do this. I know that it's going to be hard for us for a while, but I am committed to working very, very hard. And I'm also going to give this a year. If it doesn't work out in a year, I will simply go back to work. And I committed to that. And they committed to me also to supporting me and being understanding. And then the second layer of asking for help and support was to go to people who were more experienced and wiser than me, who had done this. And so my mentors, people like Doug Mitchell, who is basically a brand unto himself in public radio, my circle of friends, other women in media, and also my siblings. One is a graphic designer. The other one is a systems person in IT. And I said to one, please make a logo for me and design a website. I said to the other one, please build the website. I have no idea what I'm doing. After we did those two things, I sent out a massive email to everyone in my contacts list, hundreds of people saying we're open for business. And then to also commit to understanding that I was a novice in the business world. And so there was so much that I had to learn very quickly. That meant subscribing to the Harvard Business Review and subscribing to Fast Company and looking online at TED Talks that were about business and entrepreneurship. I mean, just amassing knowledge about how all of this works. And thankfully, I was a journalist for 18 years. And so doing research, finding information, second nature to me. And sitting and reading through things for 8 or 10 hours a day was never a problem for me. And so those initial months for me as a founder were really about understanding podcasting and also understanding how business at my level of business worked and what were the things that were necessary.
I want to take it a little bit more from the top of having you explain what was the vision for your company. You knew that you needed the help and you asked for it, which is great. Not a lot of people will do that. You found mentors. You pulled from within your ranks from everything from graphic design to tech support. What was the vision of what you were building and where is it now 3 years later?
Great question. I can happily report that the product matches the vision 100%.
Yay!
And that is marvelous reality to live in. So my vision for the company was to bring creators from the margins to tell stories how they wanted to tell stories that also centered people from the margins. That is exactly what we're doing. That vision is reflected in 70 Million, in Latina to Latina, in Feeling My Flow, in How to Talk to Mommy and Papi About Anything.
Excellent. And you also have a lot of external clients. So you're producing shows like that, and I love all of them. But you have clients like Marvel and Macmillan Podcasts and even NPR, yes?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, NPR affiliates. So we've done a couple of pilots. There's a wonderful show called Truth Be Told by the very brilliant Tanya Mosley. She wanted to re-envision that show, which had been in existence at KQED. And so she came to me and said, hey, let's do a pilot together for the show and for my new vision. We also have done seasons of shows. So we did the third season of Offshore, which was an investigative documentary series looking at the relationship between the Marshall Islands and the United States through the lens of illegal adoptions. That was fascinating to work on. Right now, we have a beautiful project that we're working on for Macmillan that will debut in the fall. That has been a year in the making, and it's also documentary style work. And we're so, so proud of that. And so we've just had a lot of opportunities to work on projects that dig into stories that are seldom told. And that's when we get really excited.
Are these all women of color who are the writers or producers or talent? Because you specialize in supporting women podcasters. But what are the parameters that you put on Lentigua Williams?
I always focus on the storyteller. It's not that I have a preference or a specialty, but it happens that the type of stories that we're making attract other similar stories. And so, yes, a large percentage, 92% of our collaborators are women of color. But that's not by design. It's really by default because of the type of storytelling that we want to do. But if a white cisgender male came to me with an amazing story that put a woman of color at the center, very likely that I would follow up on that project, right? And so it's about the storytelling always. So no, for client work, we will work with almost anyone. We first and foremost adhere to journalistic ethos and ethics because that's where I come from. That's my training. It is a place that I'm very comfortable in. We don't do fiction. So that takes out half of podcasting. If we have a client approach us about a project that is journalistically sound, that is based on reality, and that does not promote anything that would put into question our values, then yes, we're going to explore that relationship.
Okay, that's great. And it really is all encompassing. And I love that it's driven by the content, not by the person creating the content.
Absolutely.
Got it. Okay. You've called yourself a hyphenated American. What does that mean?
How many episodes do we have? Well, literally, I have a hyphenated last name because I married someone else. And so I wanted to keep my identity as myself. I married in my early 30s. I was fully grown by then, but I'm also an immigrant. And so I came from a different reality entirely where I was born and raised until I was 10. And then I gained consciousness in the United States, essentially as having been an outsider, as having come from someplace else. So that in a way is my hyphenated existence. I am also bilingual. I am bicultural. I also straddle two worlds because my mom is a non-English speaker. The rest of my family is Spanish monolingual. And so I exist exactly at the cusp of where these two cultures and these two languages meet. And so that makes me hyphenated, but I'm also very politically hyphenated in that I have ascribed and I have performed the values that I ingrained from my new country, but I'm also able to question some of the things that we do as a society. And right now is a moment of deep reckoning for us. And so I, as a hyphenated American, am having very serious conversations with people in my life about how do I expand and expound on these values that I have so that we can contribute to the next level, so that we can get to the place that we rightfully need to be to really reflect who we are today.
So many of your shows are plain spoken truth and embracing topics of conversation that historically or in certain segments of society might feel uncomfortable. And that's another, I think, hallmark of Lantigua Williams, which I love. And I want to bring up one of them, which you mentioned earlier, feeling my flow. And I think that that maybe it's a stretch, but a way that we can look at a hyphenated existence. I think that girls sometimes have to feel that they're not allowed to talk about their periods. And so you have to be a girl, but not a girl a week, a month, or what have you. How did that show come about?
This is a great story. So this is a show that was pitched to me by Mia Warren. And Mia and I did not know one another, but we had a friend in common. And typically when I meet someone for the first time, I set a 30-minute limit on the conversation because I talk to a lot of people throughout the week. And this is how I'm able to do that because I keep them short and sweet. Well, Mia and I talked for an hour and 15 minutes because everything she was saying, I was just lapping up. She started out with, hey, I have an idea to do something on astronauts menstruating in space. She had me at astronauts menstruating in space. And everything that followed was gold. By the end of that conversation, we had the whole concept for the show. We had a name for the show. I literally ended the conversation by saying, okay, I'm going to send you a contract by tomorrow. And she was like, wait, what? We're going to make the show, right? This is why you called me. And she's like, wait, seriously, we're going to make the show? And I was like, well, weren't you calling me to pitch a show? I'm taking the show. It was like, that was only the second time that I'd done that, sight unseen, where I had talked to the creator and said, yes, I am in. One of the best decisions that I've made in the last 3 years.
Well, that's one of the things that was in the news and why I had to call you, because you just got mentioned in the Washington Post and you got a good distribution deal recently with it, right?
Yes. We had done 2 seasons and we were loving the show and the show was finding its audience. And then a couple of months ago, PRX announced Trax, which is a new preteen focused network. Literally, as soon as that announcement came through my email box, I emailed Carrie Hoffman, CEO of PRX, and I said, hey, Carrie. She and I have a friendly relationship. I said, hey, Carrie, I think Feeling My Flow would be perfect for Trax. And she said, funny you should mention it because you're on my list of people to talk to. And she connected me to Michelle Smalley, who's the executive producer of Trax. And then a couple of months later, we were one of 2 shows, along with Time Storm, that debuted the entire network. And so it's just been wonderful.
Yay. Well, the angle in the Washington Post actually leads us to another talking point. In the Post, they described how our quarantine time is a really good time to talk to kids about things that might be uncomfortable, but it's really good bonding time and talking time. And I don't know if that sparked your next new show, but you're the host of How to Talk to Mommy and Poppy. And I know that you've had to practice during quarantine because of your now 8 and 10-year-olds. But what was the sort of synchronicity or symbiosis of those 2 shows?
I have to confess that I am a recovering political scientist. I have my undergraduate degree in political science, and I am definitely a social scientist in hiding. I see patterns and trends, and I analyze human behavior just innately. And so How to Talk to Mommy and Poppy came about because of one of those moments. One of my very best friends, her mother is 71 and her husband is 73. And they were perfectly happy in their winter home in Florida, where they usually take their winters. They have an apartment in New York City. And about 2 days before New York City locked down for COVID, her mom called her and said, hey, we're renting a car and driving to New York City. And my friend was aghast. She couldn't believe it. She was like, are you crazy? This is the epicenter of the entire pandemic. Well, 2 days later, mom and stepdad showed up in New York City. She and I are talking literally by the hour about what's happening. How are things going? Are they safe? What are you going to do? Then I start thinking, why am I not so alarmed by this? What is it about the cultural context and the intergenerational dynamics? Because my friend is Latina. In Latino cultures, that makes a scenario like this not just plausible, but almost predictable. And so I'm just sitting in my house analyzing this whole situation and thinking, she's not the only one going through this. She's definitely not the only one.
So this was all sparked by the issue of children dealing with parents and parents dealing with children.
Exactly.
And it doesn't matter that they were 70 something. It's always a challenge.
Exactly. And so the idea was to spend some time looking at how first generation Americanized children of immigrants, which was my friend's situation, and it's my situation too, how we straddle that generational hyphen between our parents who come from different cultures. They were full grown adults with children when they came to the United States, or they were full grown adults on their own right and then had children here in the United States. Their children are growing up in very different environments. And sometimes it really comes to a head. And sometimes there are years of lingering misunderstandings. And it impacts all facets of life, finances, education, labor, marriage, all kinds of things.
I love that you have a platform where you can create a show to talk about something that sparks you, whether it was sparked by astronauts menstruating or older parents moving in with children and things like that. But you've done so many things in media. As I said earlier, you've been the writer, the editor, and then you explain how you learned to be a founder. And I should say, I love this little factoid about you, that you wrote the last article in the last physical edition of the magazine Jet. So you've got some craft. What drove you to podcasting as a form? I mean, that was sort of like the Wild West. There you are thinking, all right, now I'm going to give up my day job.
I fell in love with podcasting, honestly.
What made you fall in love with it?
Serial, of course. It was Serial. because, as you know, I'm a storyteller, I'm a journalist, I seek out stories, right? I was in complete awe of the story development, the pacing, the character development. I mean, this was a novel, right? In my ear, week to week. And then I got recruited to go work at NPR on a desk that produces podcasts. And I thought, okay, this is clearly a sign. This is clearly an omen. And then when I was at NPR, I was able to learn the process of making audio and forget it.
That was it.
That was it. There was no turning back.
That's literally the perfect line to say, and that's all she wrote.
Well, I've written scripts since then. I've written a lot of blurbs for episodes. I've done some writing and I write essays every once in a while or columns when I'm invited to. But I love the collaborative nature of podcasting. I love working in teams. I love how podcasting gets to the point. You talk to the person you want to talk to. You say the thing you want to say. It is so clear, right? At least on the nonfiction side, right? It is completely transparent what we're doing. I also love how you can create worlds with just sound. The first time that I saw those bar graphs of sound being moved around and layered, oh my God, my head completely exploded. It was wonderful.
This is a show, this is a B2B podcast. This is about the media marketing and advertising industry. And you're representing a podcast founder very well and a successful one. But now here's the tough question. How are you making money?
Oh, we're making a little money.
Really?
Yeah. The first big money that we got was our first year because I sent a cold email to the MacArthur Foundation and said, I have an idea for a criminal justice podcast for you. And 7 months later, they gave us money to produce $70 million. And that was able to pay me just a little bit, to pay the company just a little bit, so that then I could spend more time developing more clients. So they renewed that grant 2 years. So for the first 3 years, we have this MacArthur grant. And then in the meantime, we have developed a cadre of clients. So our very first client was the Phi Beta Kappa Society. They found me on the Air Media Talent Directory and reached out and said, hey, we're thinking about starting a podcast. Can we talk? And I was like, absolutely. They led us to another client, NACAC, and now we produce their podcast. So it's been like that. And now Marvel is a client and they came to us because a producer who used to do work for us is now in-house at Marvel. And so it's a lot of goodwill. And then occasionally I will be very cheeky and pitch someone that they should have a podcast like I did earlier this week. It's a combination. I'm the CEO, which is basically chief sales officer. And so I'm selling. I'm trying to sell. But we do have income, actually. So the other thing that happened was that I basically emptied out my 401k, my life savings. And so definitely not recommendable. I've been very blessed that it's worked out really well for me. And so besides what the company has to pay me back, which is long-term, we've been profitable. I'm very proud of that.
So you have this core competency in finding good talent, and you as the CEO are empowered to make the big decisions, the executive decisions that we're going to bring on that talent. And you've gotten grants, and then you've been hired to produce things. How does the monetization work in terms of advertising? Do you have your shows repped by other companies? Do you bring in sponsors?
Both. So our biggest show is Latinas to Latinas. That's the first one that we were able to start monetizing through ad sales. So we work with two different agencies. We don't have an exclusive with any one of them. We basically, on a case-by-case basis, say, yes, we have inventory for those 8 inserts, or we don't have inventory for that. And so far, as of, I think, February, Latina to Latina is able to pay for the cost of making an episode, which I think is really, really great. I mean, Alicia and I, as co-owners, were working for free, but that's par for the course. We had set that goal when we launched to be our first financial hurdle, to get to the point where from each episode, we can pay the producer and the mixer and the social media person. And so we reached that goal earlier this year, and that was fantastic. So that's a show that almost always has an ad in every episode. And then we've also now started to do RSS drops into that show. So we will either drop a whole episode or we will drop a trailer for another show. And that is also a really good model for us. The numbers are really great on the return for the advertiser. So that's another way. We've also done some pitching to very big cosmetics company to do live events. We did one live event in New Jersey where Alicia interviewed Dolores Huerta, and that was really well attended. We definitely want to branch out. The plan was to do like a little tour to test the waters this year, but because of COVID, that's out the window for now. And we also sell merchandise. We have some nice swag. With Latina to Latina, we've been able to do that. With Feeling My Flow, the hope is that because of the network, because of Trax, they will start to sell, you know, network shows in bundles. And so then eventually when our listenership grows, we will also be able to monetize that. But Trax was able to give us a grant, you know, in exchange for the licensing of the show. And that really helped. That covered about 80% of the total production costs for the shows that we have on there. We're only 3 years old, right? And that show is only about a year and a half old. And so I feel like we're right on track to where we're supposed to be with the shows. And I'm really happy about that.
It's really remarkable. Talk about Trax. It's very fast tracked. And yet you've also diversified, and talk about diversity. You've also diversified.
Ah, look at you with the puns.
Yeah, I know. It's a problem being me. Seriously, though, you started something called Podcasting Seriously.
I did. When I envision monetization for the company as a whole, I didn't just rely on audio. Right from the very beginning, I wanted to branch out into other genres, but also into other fields. And so I basically decided to be the test dummy for an events line at the company. And so we launched this with an amazing producer, Denise Bennett, who used to produce Work It. And so she and I came up with the concept, ironed out how we wanted to do it, how it was going to be priced, you know, what the sequencing was going to be. We worked all that out. And we are actually at about 40 attendees per session, which has been absolutely astounding. I was joking with her that I was like, if we could get 10 people, that'd be so great. And our early bird passes sold out within 2 weeks. I do a lot of mentoring and I love that part of my job. But I know that there are a lot of people not only trying to come into the space, but that they're also trying to really solidify their place in the space. And I feel like I've learned so much in the last 3 years about how to navigate your place and how to create your place in podcasting, that it's beneficial to share that knowledge.
So now that you're at the place where your work reflects the vision you had when you started this, what's the vision for the next 3 years?
We have to scale. We absolutely have to scale because I have a lot of ideas. I get pitched ideas every week that really deserve to be made, but I don't have capacity because we are a very small company. There are so many stories that are worth telling. There are so many stories that need to be told, but I can't do it. You know, I have limited funds. And so for this year, I have set a goal to start on the road to outside investors, which was something that I wanted to prepare for. It was something that I wanted to strengthen the company to come to the table with a real bargaining position and with real value. And so as the CEO, that is on my big to-do list for this year because the creators that we work with and the stories that we're creating deserve to have the backup of someone who believes in them and someone who sees also the value in the future audiences that we're creating. Because that's the other thing about doing this work, that we are quite literally bringing a whole new audience into podcasting as an industry. And actually, something very exciting is that Lantigua Williams & Co. was co-sponsors with other media companies of the first ever Edison research study of Latino listeners. And so for the very first time, we're going to have qualified, quantified data about the listening habits and the profiles of Latino listeners. And that's part of my vision, which is to say, look, there is this audience, you're not paying attention to it. And as it happened with television, you're going to be late to it. So Let's start paying attention a little bit earlier than some of the other big media players.
Well, we are so way late to paying attention to all voices as a nation.
Yes.
It's not just with Latino voices. But do you think that given our current state of affairs, where people are hopefully sitting up and paying notice a little bit and examining their cultural proclivities. Do you think that the environment is better, getting better? Do you have hope for the ability to scale more easily with our maybe greater awareness and sensitivities?
Honestly, I have no idea because we've been here before. This is not the first time that a huge portion of the country has demanded change and we've been ignored. And so I'm a skeptical New Yorker when it comes to this, that I am fully committed to doing my part in it, but I am also fully committed to continuing the work despite whatever the policymakers decide. And so I have always been in that place where whatever I can do within my small sphere of influence, I'm going to continue to do it. Washington, D.C. and Congress be, you can do whatever you want, but I'm going to continue doing the work because that's where change happens. Now, what do I think has happened this time that's different? I think this time, because the younger generation of white Americans has grown up with a far more multicultural friend base and a far more multicultural and diverse schoolmates, they don't really differentiate as much as the previous generations, but it's going to come at a cost. And this is something that Black leaders have been saying forever, which is, it's not enough to come to the rallies and the marches. You actually have to go home and confront your relatives. And you have to go home and have the conversations with them about why their beliefs are so outdated and dangerous, right? And so I feel like until all of these conversations are happening in the privacy of people's homes, in addition to marching on the streets, we're not going to get anywhere because there is a huge generational gap that needs to be bridged. And the only people who can bridge it are the young people who are related to those older people who are just holding on to things that don't exist anymore.
I love that that is how we can wrap up this show because you've left us not only with homework.
Go talk to your parents and your uncles and your aunties.
That's right. It's a new show. It's not just how to talk to mommy and papi. It's how to talk to your knucklehead neighbor or
yes,
your cousin who doesn't get it or what have you. That's great. And out of the mouths of babes sometimes, I think, is where change comes. So we have to be open to listening. And I hope everyone will be open to listening to all of the shows that come out of LaAntigua Williams and Company.
Thank you.
Really, really terrific job. And I'm not your mother. I'm not your mommy. But I'm so happy to say I'm really proud of you, Julia.
Oh, my God. Stop.
Thank you, everyone, for listening to another episode of Insider Interviews. And if you know what's good for you, you'll run and rate this episode as 5 stars because she's going to be scaling quickly, everyone. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Well, I hope you got some good inside scoop from this episode of Insider Interviews with me, E.B. Moss. And I also hope that you'll rate, review, subscribe wherever you download your podcasts. You know the drill. Apple, Stitcher, Google, iHeart. Thanks again for listening.